the title that we gave for the retreat is Imagination. And I've been thinking about this for a long time, how our spiritual life is really a life of the imagination. So, briefly, what I was trying to do last night in my talk was to redefine the word imagination and the idea of the imagination. We live in such a relentlessly materialistic world. And by materialistic, I don't just mean we buy a lot of stuff. I mean our worldview, and therefore our view of ourselves and of our lives, is relentlessly materialistic. The only thing that's real is the stuff. So the body is real, and this room is real, but your soul is not as real. Your emotions are not as real as this stuff. We all believe that because we live in a relentlessly materialistic world. This is the worldview of our time and place. And according to that worldview, the imagination is the opposite of the real. So what's real is concrete and, you know, substantial. The imagination is like entertainment, what we do for a little recreation. But it doesn't really matter and it's not really real. So what I was trying to do in my talk last night, I don't think I did it too well, actually. At least it seemed like a lot of people didn't understand what I was trying to say, which means that I failed to communicate. So what I was trying to do was say that actually it's the other way around, that the imagination is more real, as real and more real, than the objective, so-called objective material world. Because we even know this. From science, we know that this world of appearances that we're living in, this world of, you know, floors and chairs and tables and individual human beings, is not actually what's going on. I mean, we know that. We know that there's tremendous space in between every atom, that it's atoms and particles and processes that are invisible. We know that. And we know that our sense organs are producing a world that is essentially either only a slice of the world or a complete illusion. And now we know that when we put together a world out of our sense organs and our conceptual apparatus, it is not necessarily what's actually going on out there. So that we're creating a world by our imaginations. Literally, that's the case, and that the imagination puts together a world. So, far from the idea of the imagination as being, you know, less real and just a recreational fantasy toy, the imagination actually is vitally important to us. It creates a world and it makes a world for us. So that's what I was trying to say last night. Somehow our soul, our spirit, our whole heart is involved every day simply in our living in this world, perceiving it, and trying to continue to be a person in it. So, to take that seriously, and to think, therefore, I need to strengthen and enhance and advance my imagination, opens our hearts and opens up the world for us. The world that we live in that can be so oppressive is not actually the one we need to live in. It's not the one that's given to us. It's the one we've created by our mutual spell. Not just individually, but all of us together have created this kind of spell And I told a story, if you were here last night, about an amazing case of someone breaking a spell and changing reality. And when we lose sight of this need for developing the imaginative side of our lives, when we lose track of it, we end up living in a fantasy world. Fantasy being the opposite of imagination. Fantasy, yeah, being distraction, entertainment, triviality. When we don't develop and take seriously the imagination, our world becomes a fantasy. And wherever you look, you're going to see distraction, addiction, an absolute mania for consumption and accumulation, even if not accumulation of stuff, then accumulation of experiences, of people, of relationships. You're going to see gross injustice as people try to figure out, like, why are they unhappy? And they figure out it's because of them, or her, or him, or this group, or that group. So then you have, you know, all these things that, you know, it's unbelievable, you know, that you have the kind of racism and sexism and all these things that you have. It's really, how could that be? It's so counterintuitive and counter to what anybody wants, and yet it's so endemic. You can't get rid of it. The world we live in, I sort of concluded my talk last night, the world we live in is more than anything else a failure of the imagination. It's a failure of the imagination, and so therefore that side of our lives needs to be strengthened and developed. And for me, it's the arts. As we think of the imagination, usually we, in its most positive light, we think of, you know, the arts. But it's not only the arts, it's also spirituality, it's also religion. I think all religion comes from this human need for the imagination. And the reason I'm bringing this up now is pretty obvious. It's because at this moment, anybody in this world who's paying attention at all, and even everybody who's not paying attention, is dismayed and is in despair, whether consciously or not, over the state of the world now. Nobody can escape that. You know, nobody can escape that. You can try to ignore it, as most people do, because it's too hard to confront. But even if you try to ignore it, it's there. It becomes one of the reasons why we're so crazy. Mostly, you really can't sustain the thought of the condition of the world for very long because it seems so utterly hopeless. Socially, who can imagine a way in which economic justice is going to manifest in this world we live in? You can't even imagine. You can dream about it, but it seems hopeless. After all this time, you'd think that there's no more racism. And maybe we were even thinking, yeah, that's right, we got over that. But now we realize, oh no. Not even close. Environmentally. Now we know, you know, well, this is a total catastrophe and it can't be reversed, no matter what we do. Be nice to not make it worse every single day as we're doing, but even if we didn't make it worse every single day, it would still be a catastrophe. So who can think about this, right? Who can sustain a thought about this? The only reasonable conclusion would be total despair. And that's right. If the only way we can think about this is objectively and materially right, we should be in despair. Because you can't really think of objective fixes to these problems. And that's why it becomes absolutely necessary for us to develop our imaginations, to develop a wider view, a view that's more inclusive and sees more, literally sees more than the objective view can see. Expanding on our imaginations, we can have a realistic vision about our personal and collective future, which is at the same time realistic but also wide, limitless, and especially, essentially hopeful. We can be honestly and realistically hopeful about this world if we can develop the imagination, if we can develop ourselves spiritually. I think we can be quite inspired in a positive way, even in this historical moment, without being pie in the sky unrealistic. If you really think about it, it makes perfect sense to be hopeful. Hopefulness is a practice. As long as there's a moment of life, think about this, whenever there's a moment of life, there's a present moment of living. What does that mean? That means there's going to be another moment, right? Think about that. As soon as you could say, this moment is arising and there is not going to be another moment, then you're dead. You're not alive anymore. If you're alive, no matter what condition your life is in, you could be hours away from your death, but if you're alive in this moment, there is a next moment. And in that next moment, no one can know what's going to happen. In other words, that next moment is full of possibility. As soon as there's no future, life is ended. And no one knows what happens in a future. That's what makes it a future, right? Its potential is absolutely unknown. If we cultivate our imaginative practice and see our practice not just as fixing me, even though, as we all know, we wouldn't be here if we didn't see, oh yeah, this does help me a lot, actually. Personally, it helps me a lot. But if we see the practice as not only being that, but much more than that, we can learn how to have a realistically hopeful feeling about the future, no matter what happens. In other words, we're not hoping it should be this way or that way. We might hope for that, but we know it might not be this way or that way, but whatever way it is, we know when we cultivate our hearts imaginatively that we can meet that moment with inspiration and joy. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we understand, in the imagination, we understand that there are no atomized individuals. The wideness of our practice completely shows us, just like in our big walking circle, you know, we're walking together. And that's what's inspiring, right? Even if something bad happens, we're walking together in a circle, and that's good. And we'll be okay. Together. So no matter what happens, it makes sense to be hopeful. And that's why I'm kind of, because in a way it's like, why do we need the word imagination? We don't need that word, you know. In a way, I felt like I was confusing everybody last night because I was using the word in the opposite sense. People kept saying, but the imagination isn't real. I said, no, I'm trying to say the opposite. Anyway, it's not the word that's important. It's the spirit of an expansive and hopeful view that comes from the process of our practice, that gives us the energy and the strength to live in this present with an unknown future. That's why I want to use the word imagination, because I want to use it as a kind of a can opener to open up the box that's too small, I think, of spiritual practice and even art practice. gotten too small. All these little boxes have gotten, each one on their own little shelf, completely divorced from the other, too small. So, I was also saying last night that Mahayana Buddhism is a version of spiritual practice that is an expansive, imaginative projection. As you know, in early Buddhism, the metaphor for practice was suffering, end of suffering, you are suffering, I am suffering. Through the practice, I can end my suffering, you can end your suffering. Individual liberation is the metaphor and the goal. In Mahayana Buddhism, without contradicting this or arguing against it, but including it, Mahayana Buddhism proposes the metaphor of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is an imaginative being who practices not only for herself and her own liberation, which is achieved and then the practice ends, but rather the Bodhisattva practices forever and ever and ever, because she knows that there couldn't be such a thing as personal liberation, because there couldn't be such a thing as an atomized person apart from other people, that the only liberation that there could be is universal liberation and compassion and love and identification with everyone and everything. So that Bodhisattva would practice forever and ever and ever, be reborn again and again and again out of love and concern for others, and joyfully going on and on and on with practice to benefit others. So that's the kind of vision of Mahayana Buddhist practice. That's its proposed ideal and goal, a kind of endless and impossible ideal and goal that we would actually carry out, and we would actually do. When you do your spiritual practice with this vision in mind, basically, it doesn't matter what happens to you. It's a shocking thing to say, but it's true. Because you know that your life, your actual life, your life in the scope of the imagination is not the life it looks like you're living. The story of the life it looks like you're living, the plan that you're living out, which probably somebody else gave you and they thought it was reasonable, so you took it up, you know. This plan for your life that looks like the life you're living is not really the life you're living. Your life, it looks like you run a recycling company, but actually you're a bodhisattva, practicing infinitely for the benefit of others. Usually in our lives, you know, we want things. We would like to have enough money. I think we're not that greedy. We don't need to be the richest person in the world, but we need enough money. We would like to have a nice place to live, good relationships, nice meals, be educated, be good people. We would like that things turn out well for our loved ones, and we try to bring these things about, and we're disappointed when they don't work out, and we're really happy when they do. Bodhisattvas don't think like that. They think about their infinite vow to love, protect, and save all beings. They think of their infinite vow to continue to practice and learn more and more and more, and open up more and more and more limitless practices. If you read the Mahayana Sutras, sometimes there are passages that contain page after page after page, going on for hundreds of pages, about different bodhisattvas and all the vows that they take. Bodhisattvas are vowing beings. That's the way that they project their imagination forward. They take these vows. I will be reborn again and again until the following happens. And they go on and on with all these amazing things. So you might say, well, that's fine for bodhisattvas. They're imaginative beings. They aren't real like us. We're real. We're human beings. And that is true. I think it would be a folly for us to deny that we are human beings living in a material world that is difficult. That would be folly, to pretend somehow that we had left that behind. But to me, it's equally folly to leave it at that, to say that's all we are, because that's not all we are. We are that, but we're also imaginative beings. Human beings, this is one of the characteristics of human beings, we have unlimited imaginations. We can imagine things that could never exist, like we were saying last night, a Catholic rabbi. You could never have a Catholic rabbi. A rabbit with lips. You couldn't have that. But we could imagine that. You could even get a postcard with a picture of it, you know? Because we have imaginations like that, that can't imagine what doesn't exist and could never exist, this is why we can never be satisfied with just what exists. This is why human beings will never be satisfied. That's why when you see like people who are very wealthy, now we have this phenomenon of numerous people. It used to be like just a few kings here and there, but now it's like numerous people all over the place with seemingly unlimited amounts of money. And they're trying to get more and do more, because I'm sure they're not satisfied. I actually have a friend or two who have almost unlimited amounts of money, and I can tell you, they're not satisfied because they have unlimited imaginations, and nothing in this limited world will ever satisfy them or us. And again, if we only have this world, we get crazy. If that's all we have and that's all we see, we get crazy. We are narcissistically dissatisfied, and out of that dissatisfaction, we do all the terrible things that we do in this world. So we can't be satisfied by any amount of money or education or relationships or any of that. Not that we don't need all of that in our lives. Of course we need that, but that will not satisfy us in the end. The only thing that will satisfy us is this endlessly deep an altruistic, imaginative, spiritual perspective. It's only an unlimited vision that can match our unlimited hearts and our imaginations. So, for bodhisattvas, all the stuff of our lives, our careers, our relationships, our household, our bank account, it all actually matters. It's important. But it's important because this is the tools that we apparently need. Here I am with what I've got. This apparently is what I need to do my bodhisattva work. That's why I have it. That's what it's for. So I take it seriously, but not as mine. I don't think any of it is mine. I think it's only a temporary materials and tools that I've been given to carry out my bodhisattva work. So each one of us is way bigger than we appear. Any human being you meet, without exception, is basically a sacred, amazing bodhisattva. They may not know it, they may not appreciate it, but if you're a bodhisattva, you can see it. That's why every person you meet, you have complete respect for. And you're like, awesomely staggering with meeting that person. and seeing their bodhisattva heart, whether or not they can see it. You know it's there. Each one of us is way bigger than we think we are. And our responsibility and our capacity is way beyond anything that we can imagine. We have to be as big as our imaginations are, and we really are that big. We have to take ourselves less seriously as persons, the persons we think we are, and more seriously as bodhisattvas. Now, I know that probably nobody in this room is a San Francisco Giants fan. Yes, my St. Louis Cardinals friend back there is thumbs down on the Giants. But that's only because the Giants have beaten the Cardinals several years in a row. Not this year, but anyway, that aside, I will now quote Bruce Bochy on the question, the manager of the Giants, who's a wise person, on this question of being bodhisattva. Here's what he says. He says, we take this game seriously. We just don't take ourselves seriously. In other words, we take this big project of being bodhisattva seriously, and we don't worry so much about our smaller cover story of being who we are. And wouldn't that be nice, not to be so worried about that? You know, think about that. Like somebody you didn't know from on the other side of town, you might be concerned about that person, but you know, if something bad happens to them, you say, well, that's too bad, but it's not such a big deal. Imagine if you thought about that way about yourself. You know, yes, I'm concerned about her, but it's not so bad. We're not worried that much, whatever happens. It'll be part of the path. It'll be fine. So that's the vision of the bodhisattva, which is the whole thrust of the Mahayana Buddhist path. And Zen, as you know, is a Mahayana Buddhist school. But incidentally, my observation, and you've all been around a lot, and maybe you think it's different, but what I've seen so far is that in our world, meaning the West Coast, the United States, maybe Canada, Mexico, the distinctions of the different Buddhisms has fallen away. So, all the Buddhisms are mixed up together, right? So I've done lots of Vipassana practice and have lots of colleagues who are Vipassana teachers and all the different. So what I'm saying here, to me, it seems to apply equally to all forms of Buddhist practice. I think this is an emerging Western Buddhist vision that all the different jhanas share equally. That's my impression so far. Anyway, the most ordinary description of the path for bodhisattvas, the practice of bodhisattvas, the most normative description of that path is the six paramitas, that the bodhisattvas practice six practices. And this is their activity, and they develop these six practices over many, many lifetimes, and they never stop practicing these six practices. And the six practices are giving, generosity, dana, as we've heard Tim talking about dana. He's talking about dana in terms of a retreat, you know, giving gift to the teacher at the retreat, but dana is a much bigger practice than that. That's one part of it. So that's the first of the six practices, dana paramita. Then the second one is sila, or ethical conduct, which is an immense practice. It means all conduct, everything we do, body, speech, and mind. And then patience, or forbearance, the ability to be strong and forbearing in the face of adversity, especially. Because bodhisattvas eat up adversity. For breakfast, they have adversity, difficulty. And they have an even bigger helping for lunch. And if they're not ordained, they even have it for dinner. So that's why a difficult future is no problem for a bodhisattva, because all they think is, ah, excellent, big problems ahead, a chance to practice kshanti paramita. Ah, great. And virya, paramita, energy, and the practice of, you know, always bouncing back and showing up again, even if you're dragging your butt, it doesn't make any difference. You know, you're tired, you're there. You're energetic, you're there. In both cases, you find a way within your condition, whatever it is, to show up completely in a way that is consonant with that condition, but yet an upwelling, uprising mind. Dhyana, paramita, meditation. Coming back to the cushion over and over again with faithfulness, focusing the mind, fearless, seeing what's there. And prajnaparamita, the practice of transcendent wisdom. Sometimes they translate prajnaparamita as wisdom beyond wisdom. Wisdom that looks out at the world with eyes of imagination. And doesn't see just the world that's laying there flat on the plate. Sees the world three-dimensional and full. Actually sees it that way. That's prajnaparamita. So now I'm going to stop talking. And that's the end. And I hope I'll say more about these six practices as we go on.